And welcome back to Coast, David Talbot with us, Wallace Thornhill. Their websites are both linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Wallace, we really haven't talked a lot about yours. Tell us about it. It's Holo Science?
That's right, HOLOscience.com.
Okay, very good.
The idea being that it's holistic, it connects all subjects in an interdisciplinary fashion, because it's my view that any real cosmology cannot have any exceptions. It doesn't matter what the question is, it must have some connection with all other subjects. And I think that's the difference between my approach and that of standard cosmology now, which appears to be purely a theoretical mathematical exercise.
Dark matter, dark energy? What is it?
They're only required to make the equations work.
That's probably true. Probably true. And I mean, do scientists even have an idea what it is?
No. All they know is that they need something to make their equations work so that spiral galaxies can form and so that planets can form and so on. But when it comes to looking at the evidence, none of these theories really stack up. And they're based on some really fundamental problems in understanding. The problem is basically one of mathematicians not understanding the variables that they use. For instance, the one for gravity is Newton's equation, which relates the force between two bodies to the two masses divided by the square of the distance between them. You'll notice that time isn't included, so Newton didn't include time. It should happen instantly, and Newton's equation is used for our space shots to other planets. There's the aspects of the misunderstandings about matter and Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared. We have quantum theory, which is another pillar of modern cosmology, which is a theory with no actual real understanding of what's happening. It all seems to be spooky when it gets down to the level of the atom. And yet Halton Arp's work has shown that quantum effects occur on galactic scales. So there is something fundamental missing in that area. So in all of these things, we have mathematicians playing with symbols and having a great time, because with mathematical logic, you can prove something, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything real, particularly when you don't understand the symbols that you're using.
Well, so true. Okay, let's go to some calls. We'll go east of the Rockies first. John in Conyers, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the show, John.
Good morning, gentlemen. George, Wallace sounds amazingly similar to Maurice Katerhoff.
He does sound close, yeah.
Yes, and Wallace, if you're not familiar with Maurice, he's a frequent guest on Coast, uh-huh. And I highly suggest you go to his website, Maurice Katerhoff. I think he's cracked the gravitational mystery. He solved this problem. He's defined it. He's described how it works. It sounds very similar. He said many, many similar things to you, what you said tonight.
Yeah,
also, James McKinney.
I think it's quite true that there is nothing new under the sun, and I was surprised to find that there was a fellow back in the late 1800s who addressed the Royal Society about the electrical sun, so that even the idea of the sun being an electrical phenomenon is not new.
And James McKinney, of course, physicist who is a staunch believer in the comet and Velikovsky's theories as
uh-huh.
well. As well.
Yes, there is a big difference between his idea of comets and mine, but that's by the by. I think the main thing is that we both recognize that there are electrical forces to be taken into account.
All right, David is in Anchorage, Alaska, west of the Rockies. Hey, David, thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah, you guys are one of my old-time heroes. I got your information off the net years ago. You're top of my favorites list. this is a natural philosophy question, so I have to lead up to it with kind of other fields. Now, NGC 7603, of course, is one of Alpheum's peculiar galaxies, and it proves that quasars are produced by galaxies, and ultimately they produce galaxies themselves, or evolve into galaxies themselves. Now, fact number two is NASA satellite data through the space geodesy system has proved that the Earth is expanding by 0.7 inches per year. Fact number three, Coast to Coast had a fossil of a 3-foot spider that was 100 million years old when the Earth was one-third of its size, and if it was alive today, it could not exist in the gravity that the Earth has today. Fact number four, lightning is relieving the Earth's charge differential from space, creating 200 times the amount of electricity that the Earth's dynamo could create by itself. And fact number five, proton or hydrogen-based liquids are abundant on the Earth and produced, and by the Earth producing hydrogen, it is can produce abiotic oil by combining it with carbon under tremendous pressures within the Earth itself. And so the question is, could the growth of the charge of the Earth, the growth and the charge of quasars and the charge of stars be a result of protons being produced from the quantum vacuum? And I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air.
That's for you, Wallace.
Well, there's a lot of questions in there.
Yeah, basically,
there is no such thing as a vacuum. Even the best vacuum we can create in the laboratory or even a witness in space is teeming with neutrinos, and neutrinos are a normal particle. They have vanishingly small mass, and it's my view that they actually contain the most collapsed form of matter, because Halpern-Arp himself said that it's obvious that quasars, once they're born from the center of an active galaxy, increase in mass and brightness, and their redshift reduces over time. So the question is, where is this excess mass coming from? And the answer is that it has to be associated with matter. Now, the matter must exist before it's pumped up, if you like, by the energy that's impinging on a quasar, the electrical energy. So galaxies give birth, it seems to me, to quasars, and this is stands out from Halpern-Arp's work. And in the process, the quasar accepts electrical energy from its parent over some time. In fact, it gives rise to these jets of material, these electric currents flowing between the parent galaxy and the quasar. This is all getting a bit complicated, I'm afraid, but that electrical energy doesn't just arrive at the quasar and do nothing. It actually generates the particle pairs, you know, the idea that a radiation of sufficient intensity can actually create particle pairs, electrons and positrons and so on. My view is that occurs in quasars, and also as the charge arrives, you get this polarization effect, and it's charge polarization in normal matter that gives rise to its mass. This comes back to the expanding Earth idea. I have looked at that for some time, trying to figure out how that might happen, and I've realized that really it's unnecessary. You don't have to have the Earth expanding. And the evidence from one of the researchers in the Electric Universe, or the proto-Saturn model, one of the leading researchers on it, Duarte Cardona, points out that the Earth's gravity at the time of the dinosaurs must have been much less than it is today. But it changed suddenly. The dinosaurs were wiped out by a catastrophe which included electrical exchanges, and as a result, the Earth's gravity increased. And this is the whole point, that E equals mc squared again. If you inject energy into matter, then the mass will increase, and this is exactly what happened to the Earth. It's as simple as that. As for the evidence for an expanding Earth, that's usually in the form of trying to match continental shapes together by moving them around like bits of a jigsaw puzzle. The point is that the oceanic trenches and so on
actually show the hallmarks of gigantic electrical scars running from pole to pole on the Earth, which may have had something to do with its electrical birth, because every object has a surface which is scarred both by its birth and by settling down into its final orbit. And the Earth, I think the oceanic basins are quite different from any other planet that we've seen in the solar system. So the Earth's birth was different to the other planets, although it was the same process, an electrical process. And we do not have to explain the oceanic basins by the expansion of the Earth. So that's just my view.
Okay, very good. And David, tell me about the predictions based on the principles of the electric universe. What are they?
Well, you know, on the Thunderbolts website, we do have a on our menu on the right, we do have a link to a history of predictions. Now, when it comes to the science of the electric universe, all of the predictions will be walls. I might be able to fit myself into one or another. I know I predicted that mesas would be found on the deep impact mission to Comet Tempel 1. But I'll tell you, Wal Thornhill has registered predictions over the years that have been successful up to a level achieved, to the best of my knowledge, by no other theorist. I'm speaking of theorists who are offering predictions that challenge the expectations of the scientific mainstream. This is where Wall really has shone brightly. And when we were on the eve of the deep impact missions, dropping a probe onto the comet Tempel 1, we published a series of predictions. These were essentially the predictions that had been given by Wall. And there was a stunning success to this. I mean, for example, Wall said, well, the energies are going to be much larger than they've imagined. They weren't expecting much at all. But Wall was realizing that you're dealing with charged objects. In relationship to each other, the charge could be quite substantial. And I remember watching that event, and I just remember the screen just being almost filled with this spectacular blast. And everybody was stunned. And the absence of water, the subsequent alteration of the jets from the comet nucleus and so on, this kind of thing is not a standard prediction. I don't believe that anybody came close to Wal Thornhill's predictions with respect to comets.
Yeah, I think, David, the one that was picked up by Wired magazine was the, I predicted there would possibly be an electrical flash before it actually struck the comet.
Yes.
And that was borne out. It was explained away as the copper projectile, hitting a crust or something before it actually struck the solid surface beneath, which is really an outrageous suggestion. But because there was no other explanation in the standard view of a comet being just a dirty snowball or a snowy dirtball, that was all they could come up with. And it's never been mentioned since, as far as I can tell. But that flash was just what I expected, and I predicted that 4 years earlier when the mission was first announced.
I think that this role of prediction in science is one of the most overlooked principles. And I think it's overlooked primarily because the predictive ability of mainstream theory has been essentially zero. If it were anything else than zero, the path of discovery in the space age wouldn't be defined by relentless surprises. Nothing has turned out since the space age the way the models in place at the beginning of the space age had envisioned things. So prediction is the way to verify a theory. Any model is going to have, if it's worth anything, it's going to have implications that will falsify the model if it's incorrect.
That's right.
But we're not observing this now in within the sciences that there's any tendency to step back from the surprises and say, well, now, wait a minute, this number of surprises, this huge number of surprises over decades, are there any patterns to these surprises? Well, yes, there are. Virtually every surprise either specifically points to electricity or is best explained by electrical events. How could this be missed? It's because they're not thinking at the fundamental level of a true natural philosopher. That's the job of natural philosophy. It's to see where things have gone wrong. But we don't have that. We just have specialists going an inch wide and a mile deep. They're not seeing anything. So
yeah, there's another
the predictions by Walt Thornhill don't mean anything to them.
Yeah, sorry. This has been echoed by a scholar who pointed out that successful predictions have been minimized because if a maverick scientist makes the prediction, then it's not accepted because the theory is wrong. In other words, it's prejudged.
Absolutely. Let's go next. Truck driving. Dan, you're up with us in Iowa. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Just a quick comment, a couple of questions real quick. George, it's been a hell of a ride. It's too bad it's got to stop on Saturday night, but I thank you for all your fun.
We'll still be here, Dan. Not to worry.
I'll be here with you then.
You got it.
The question being, your guest said that they thought that life was possible in the universe somewhat closer than what we think it is right now. People before on this show have asked about Planet X. Is there a possibility Planet X is out there and could hold humanoid life and be in the Goldilocks zone?
You know, Wallace, we were talking about that, the possibility of a planet being in the solar system, and it very well could be.
Well, it's possible, except that the energy available to an object in the outer solar system is not conducive to life. It's just too cold.
Even if it had its own internal heating system?
Well, the most likely place for life, according to my electric universe theory, is as a satellite of a brown dwarf star, because brown dwarfs are not really dwarfs. They're actually miniature red giants. For instance, if Jupiter, if we could light up the plasma bubble of Jupiter, it would appear as big as the moon in the sky from Earth, and yet it's a huge distance away, about five times as far as the sun. So it would be as big as the sun in the sky and yet five times further away. So all of the satellites of Jupiter would be orbiting within this plasma glow. And that plasma glow is the most hospitable region for life to form and to be sustained, because there are no seasons. And also some of the atmosphere of the parent planet will form an atmosphere on the satellite.
All right. Well, we'll be back with final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David Tuplin, you've talked about the crisis in the culture of science. What do you mean by all of that?
Oh, wow. Well, it is what we've been talking about, and if I say exactly what's on my mind, it will seem like a very hard judgment on the sciences, but I tend to just say what's on my mind on this subject, whereas I'll keep to myself on some others. But I just think that the culture of science today is a disaster zone, and you can see this playing out at all the different levels within that culture. If you really want the example of the worst, look up the electric universe as it's discussed on science forums on the internet. Now, Thunderbolts.info has a higher rating in terms of the educational levels of the visitors and so on than any of the other science sites out there. But the treatment of the electric universe by these sites that are set up to defend good science, the treatment is just a joke. It's you've got variations on the class clown who are speaking of the electric universe as if the whole thing is a joke. Now, how did that happen? And that's just one symptom. Another symptom is the complete disinterest in science by students today.
That's an educational problem, too, though, isn't it?
It is just a terrible educational problem, and it does relate to what we were discussing before, which is the incredible collapse of inspiration in the sciences. No sense of discovery, no love of discovery, no sense that there are things to be learned that will enhance our world, things to be learned that will make science exciting again. There is nothing with more power to re-inspire the sciences than the electric universe. There's no greater friend of NASA than the electric universe, no greater friend of solar physicists than the electric sun. There is no movement, there are no ideas that would inspire greater interest in exploration of planets and moons than the story of what was seen in the ancient sky and what all of that means for the sciences. So I just see this horrific cloud over the sciences today that it is our mission to remove. And I love the solar physicists that I've gotten to know. It's not a large number, but I believe solar physicists are doing the best they can. But somebody has to stand up and say, you know what? We really did get the picture of the sun wrong, and it's infected all of the planetary sciences. It's affected our whole view of the universe. We got the story wrong. And once that question's posed, then the paths of discovery will be immediately open in front of us. Of this, I am so confident. So I see that we have an opportunity to gradually cultivate liaison with independent-minded scientists, and the effects will echo out, will reverberate outward into the scientific mainstream. I see so many indications of this. So I'm really, really I'm not of a positive mind with respect to the state of the sciences, but I'm of a very positive frame of mind when it comes to what is possible now in the coming years.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Astoria, New York, Mike's turn, first-time caller. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for holding so long.
Oh, no problem at all. I love your show, and the gentleman that was just talking, I can give you great merits for speaking on the rogue natural philosophers out there that there's a lack of in the scientific community. Because I actually am one of them.
Very good.
Go ahead.
And, you know, how you're talking about the crevices in the earth and the sun, you know, this and that, you know, misunderstandings. I mean, I could break it all down for you. Like, seriously. I feel that I have, you know, a lot of the traits that are lacking in the whole community today.
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it all goes down to Newton's law of gravity. What you need to understand is that, you know, with the gravitational forces and pull, when you go under the water, it's less than what's on top of the land.
All right. Well, thanks for your input and your feedback. It's nice to know there's some other scientists out there that think like you two. Alberta, Canada, Wade on the wild card line. Hey, Wade.
Hi, George.
Hi, go ahead.
I've been looking at the continental shelf on Google Maps and stuff like that, and you can see what looks like stretch marks on the continents from its striations in under the sea, and you would swear that the continents have separated. Now I know that you can add mass like comet dust and meteorites and stuff like that, but I'm sure that the continents have separated from each other.
Yeah, can I answer that one?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, there is a group of geologists now. These are your maverick scientists, if you like, who've set up their own organization, which says that the whole argument for continental drift and so on is bunk. And the evidence they have is very powerful. Now, you talked about the continental shelf. The problem is, of course, that geologists have no idea what the effects of electrical scarring of a planetary surface looks like.
And one of the aspects of that scarring is the formation of terracing, the terracing of the edges of a channel. And the continental shelves I see as being just that form of terracing. There is no real explanation for the continental shelves as they stand. The other thing is that you have a central ridge where the main discharge occurs, and you also get what's called coronal streamers, which go at right, come out at right angles to the main discharge, and they cause those striations you talked about, and also they have magnetic effects, which has been noticed in deep-sea magnetic recordings. So all of these things fit with an electrical model of the sculpting of the Earth, presumably very early in its history, maybe following its birth from a giant planet, because this is how, in the electric universe, stars and planets are made. They are formed by electrical birth, because the electric force is so overwhelmingly powerful that you can forget about gravity when these thunderbolts and that are being hurled between planets.
How do you both feel about the theory of panspermia?
Well, it's really unnecessary. I know Fred Hoyle was very interested in that idea because of his problems with the sheer improbability of life having evolved on the Earth. But if the universe, as I said, is connected by this sort of morphic field or electrical resonant connection, and the information is there somewhere else in the universe, life has evolved like us, and the information is there as to how that happens, then that information is available here on Earth when the conditions are right. So if the conditions on Earth change radically, you will get a change in all the life forms, and this is what the geological record shows, that you get these discontinuities where whole species are wiped out that were perfectly fitted to survive, and a raft of new ones appear because the conditions are now right for those particular creatures.
Okay, back to the phones. Let's go to Cookeville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning to you.
I'm glad I woke up early this morning.
Well,
but
good.
Hey, I'd like to ask the gentleman you got on, is there a website that a person could go to, I don't know if it would be you guys or not, about people who really don't believe in the Big Bang Theory? Personally, I've always thought, you know, you can't really get order out of chaos. I know I've heard a lot of people say that, but I believe that. And that there's I always thought there had to be some type of electromagnetic force that kept everything together. If not, I mean, we would just be, you know, flying around like putting a bunch of marbles in a bag and shaking them up. Yeah. I was just wondering if there's a website that somebody could look at.
Well, the website of Helton Arp gives the hard evidence for the impossibility of the Big Bang, and the evidence in favor of a more or less static universe where galaxies give birth to baby galaxies and so on, which fits the electrical model perfectly. So look up Helton Arp on the web and you will find his website. As for other things against the Big Bang, well, the NPA, the Natural Philosophy Alliance, has a lot of maverick scholars who don't believe in the Big Bang. So you'll get a lot of varied arguments against it, I think, from their website.
Okay, let's go next to Colton, California, west of the Rockies. David, go ahead. It's your turn.
Hey, I've been listening for a little while, and really impressed the guest that you have on tonight.
Thank you.
I had a couple questions about the external power source of the sun and the planets that you suggested in your wiki article. How exactly do you attribute the interior of the star then? Are just big balls of gas or or plasma? Or
Well, that's quite confronting. But the answer is that the electrical formation of stars insists that heavy elements form the core of a star. So there's no hydrogen thermonuclear reactor possible.
So they're solid?
So all bodies in the universe are made up similarly. They all have their heavy elements as a core. They have an atmosphere, once they're of a size that's able to hold an atmosphere. But depending on their size and the electric charge on them, they may also be the center of a galactic discharge, in other words, a star of some form. So that's the quick answer. The evidence for the sun not having a thermonuclear reactor is, of course, staring us in the face in the form of sunspots. sunspot is cooler than the surrounding photosphere, and yet it's a hole in the photosphere where we can see into the depths of the atmosphere of the star, of the sun. So if it's cooler beneath, there is no heat trying to escape from the sun. All of the energy is impinging from the outside. It's as simple as that.
That is quite interesting. That's a good answer. And what do you think of the current science's idea of the habitable zone that's supposed to be like a couple astronomical units from our current sun?
Yes. I'm glad you asked that question because this impinges on extraterrestrial life and the possibility of life around nearby stars. The problem is that we view the whole universe in terms of our own situation right now. But as I mentioned earlier, the most likely place for life is as a satellite of a brown dwarf star. And astronomers in recent decades have begun to echo that view. However, they still view it as an object, a satellite or a planet, orbiting at some distance from a central star, which provides the heat and the light. But that is really not the best situation because depending on your particular orientation of the planetary axis and the rotation rate, that could be quite a nasty place to live. As we find in the solar system, the Earth is the only one that's in a good position. But if you are orbiting within the electrical glow of a brown dwarf, then the energy levels are conducive to life. The entire surface of your planet receives the same amount of energy, so you can have tropics at the in the Arctic Circle, if you like, which we also observe on the Earth, by the way, in the fossil record. So the Earth has been in this situation in the past. That is the most conducive place for life. However, it does raise another interesting issue. We haven't been able to contact ET. And the reason for that is that radio waves won't penetrate the plasma, the glowing plasma shell of a brown dwarf star. So we're using the wrong signaling technique. There is another signaling technique, and it's allied to the gravitational force, but we have yet to learn how to both transmit and receive those kinds of signals, which, by the way, are instantaneous.
Will we ever learn them?
Yes, I think we will. The answers, I think, are all quite simple. The electric universe operates on the basis of repeated patterns. So the pattern we see within atoms is repeated within the particles within atoms and so on to some degree that we don't understand. But the force in action in all of these instances is the electric force, and that's the only force you need.
Well, well done, both of you. Let's go to Sharon in Aptos, California. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi.
I'm a big fan of James McCanney. Do you folks know him?
Yes, we were just talking about him, as a matter of fact.
Oh, good, 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 good. Anyway, years ago, James was talking about the electrical nature of comets and their effect on the sun. And right after that show, you know, like a week later, I have spaceweather.com bookmarked on my computer and go there often. And here is a double whammy to the sun, two comets, and there's big prominences with each one. And they have a caption that says, by the way, that's just coincidental. They don't have anything to do with it. And then just a couple weeks ago, there was another one on spaceweather.com, comet, and here's this giant prominence. By the way, that's just coincidence.
Yeah.
I wanted to know what you thought about that. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, Sharon, they're not coincidences, as you have intuited. The point is that we know that comets can have comas, that's their electrical environment, that are as big as the sun. So if you can imagine that kind of environment closing in on the sun, then there must be an electrical effect. And the response of the sun, of course, is to discharge. And that's exactly what we see.
And, of course, the reason why the NASA spokesman and so on have discounted any connection is they're just seeing these bodies acting across neutral space. They're just seeing the relative gravity of the sun and the relative gravity of the comets being so different. That little comet is completely inconsequential. But this little comet can be an electrically powerful object sufficient to trigger a discharge. And I've watched these things for like 10 years or so. And I wonder sometimes if maybe it is actually possibly a coincidence. But when you continue to see this symmetry between the approaching comet and these discharges, and you understand that it's not a matter of gravitational strength, it's a matter of electric exchange. It just seems so reasonable to look at it. There is not an article, as far as I can determine, that has ever examined within the scientific community of peer-reviewed research, has ever examined this mystery. That's yeah. just a symptom of the state of the sciences today.
Yeah, it's rather sobering to realize that our modern astronomy is still in the gaslight and horse and buggy era, while our engineers are able to send missions to the planets.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, both of you, thank you so much for being on the program. Good luck with all you both do.
Thanks,
thank
George.
Thank you very much, George.
David Talbot, Wallace Thornhill, their two works, Thunderbolts of the Gods, and, of course, The Electric Universe. Don't forget our next Coast to Coast program. We're going to talk about underground bases, possibly caverns as well.